Look at the screen. William Blake's The Great Red Dragon and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent? Smell yourself.
Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mindhunter, a podcast about Michael Mann's 1986 adaptation of Thomas Harris's Red Dragon, Manhunter. Today, I'm joined by a New York Times best-selling author and a multi award-winning crime-winning author, writer of things like The Turnout, Beware the Woman, and one of my personal favorites, The Song Is You. It's the great Megan Abbott. Hello.
Hello. So happy to be here to get to talk about a movie that means a lot to me. So I'm really excited.
I'm the most excited because last time we talked was talking about Zodiac together to celebrate its 17th birthday. And now we're recovering the mindset and we are going right in to one of the coolest scenes in movie history, as far as I'm concerned. The first meeting of Will Graham and Hannibal Lecter with a K in Manhunter. Just before we dive into the scene, can you talk to me? Because I know that obviously you're a massive fan of crime fiction. I know you're a fan of this book, particularly from Thomas Harris. I think a lot of folks have a huge association and an affinity for Silence of the Lambs because it was just like a cultural touchstone. But I've said a couple of times in recording this that, like, I actually think that Red Dragon might be my favorite book of the series. It's so economical and so, like, it does really difficult things so quickly, like setting the scene and just hurtling you into this experience. I'd love to hear what your experience was of reading and now knowing Thomas Harris's work and then approaching this movie.
Yes, this was huge for me. The book was huge for me. I read it when it came out as a tender young pubescent girl. I was really into it. I loved it, and I saw the movie in the theater, which that, you know, really was, I remember it was in this tiny theater in my local Cineplex, you know, what didn't get a huge release, and it just completely transfixed me. And to me, I know this, everyone loves Silence of the Lambs, but to me, this is the one.
Yes.
This is the better book and the better movie and the better Lecter.
Yes.
I think in every way. And I think it sort of gets unfairly retro viewed, you know, because this did everything first. So everything we're so familiar with now about the profiler and the serial killer, the way they mirror each other. Like, this is where it begins.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it's not so baroque. It's very real. And it feels, this is like really what true crime to me is. There's something really ugly and terrifying about it. It's not glamorous. It's not stylized. It's not movie stars. It's this.
Yes. And I think it's been nice to see that there is a bit of recovery, because Silence of the Lambs is absolutely a perfect film. I don't ever want to say there are, so Red Dragon is garbage and Hannibal is crazy, but Manhunter has had such a nice thing where people are like, oh, it was, you know, very stylish and things like that. It's like, yes, because you're kind of in this, I don't know, this kind of weird experiential impressionistic view of certain things in the movie, but where it is, like certain experiences in the movie, where you're unflinching is the violence. When you walk into the crime scenes and you see the carnage as it has unfolded, because you're rarely seeing things that are happening live, you're sort of seeing them retrospectively in the film. It's completely awful and dark. And it's like, there's a great French author and film critic, Jean-Baptiste Leray, who I've spoken to many times. And he's like, Blake, I don't care about story. He goes, for me, he goes, this is about, because obviously he's French, so he knows it in translation. He's like, you lose something in my translation when you read it in English. It's not exactly, doesn't have the same musicality of exactly how I write things in French. He goes, it's just the way that it is. And he's like, and I feel the same way about authors and filmmakers. It's like, you took a Megan Abbott story, but Megan Abbott doesn't write it. It's not the same thing. And much the same as Michael Mann. It's like his eye, his attention to detail, his music choice, his actor choice, his set choice, his framing. It's like everything that is him, especially with such a great structural foundation of this excellent story, is like he can throw all of his style at it. And that is actually his voice. Like that's his cinematic voice rather than the storytelling necessarily. So, I think this has always been one of my favorites as a Michael Mann crazy person and obsessive. But the more that I've been watching it and the more that I've been enjoying it, doing this series with so many familiar and new people, is everyone just going, wow, like he was in like God mode in 86. Who knew? Like who knew that he was in God mode that early? And like really just just throwing style at us. And some people were just like, oh, it didn't exactly, you know, oh, Will and Crawford were sitting on his porch in the book. I don't like that they were sitting on a log. It's like, come on, guys, come on. It's like, does the essence of the scene capture what Thomas Harris would have wanted? And I think the answer is yes.
Yes. In fact, I mean, I think you could really make the argument that it should be on a log because of the things the movie's doing with nature versus artificial, the art of everything else and the coldness of institutional structures. You know, we see that at the end of the scene we're going to talk about.
Yes.
But a desire to return to the natural. You know, I remember when the movie came out, he really got dinged for it looking too Miami Vice, because that was when Miami Vice was on. And I'm glad it's sort of divorced from that now. And I love Miami Vice. Yes. But to me, this is, and you said expressionistic, it's how everything feels to Will Graham. You know, not every scene is from his point of view, but most of them are. And I think what was particularly in the scene we're going to talk about, you see how the world feels to him. And that's the stylization. It's how it is in his head. We're seeing how in his head, how he's experiencing Lecter. So I think that's the sort of genius of it, that it's not, to me, it's not a director showing off his cool camera angles. He's really trying to get at the jagged kind of piercing thing that Will is going through. And therefore we get these angles, we get these, you know, odd camera placements, because it should feel uncomfortable and off and strange, because that's how he feels.
Exactly. And I also love what you said there. It's like you're inside his head. So you're divorced from like a need to be, I guess, photorealistic. I know that that's sort of a weird thing to say, but it's like the things that dig into you in your brain for this movie is shots and feelings. And it is not just, it's a shot, but it's the color. It's like doing these weird chemical reactions in your brain that make things stick in there. And then that's what makes it more haunting. It's like I can remember a scene of a movie or what happened. I can tell you the beats of the story, but it's like, why did it make you feel like that? Because it's like a dreamscape. Some things are so gorgeous and beautiful, and then some things are so stark and ugly. And then Will Graham in the middle, being pulled between the ugliness and the beauty, sublime. It's exactly like this kind of totemic character. It's so wonderful. And I think, as you said, it kind of got dinged, but it had a tremendous, tremendous influence. Even like the other day, the Netflix carousel, or as my son calls it, the aisle. It's like, Dad, let's go down the aisle. And the Netflix aisles are so drab sometimes. And I saw Mindhunter, a terrific David Fincher series on it. I just started watching it. And I was watching it and I was like, oh, Fincher really likes Manhunter. Like, he really, really, really likes Manhunter. I'm like, it's although it's, you know, very period accurate and things like that, it's like he does take those little flourishes with the filmmakers he works with to really get you in the head and the psychological sort of, I don't know, like, it's, you know, you can smell some of the scenes in this movie. It's got something different going on.
I agree. I don't think that show exists without this movie. No. I think it's directly drawing from stylistically elements of it, but Fincher's own style, of course, but it elementally what this movie's about is what Mindhunter's about. Yes. And of course, drawing from the same kind of, you know, the profiler mystique, and they're both kind of deconstructing it, but the fact that man's deconstructing it in 1986 before it had even taken hold, he's creating the myth and sort of poking holes in it at the same time, which I think is one of the, which I think is what you really see in his casting choices foremost, which is, you know, we'll talk about with Brian Cox, but it's such a different choice than Anthony Hopkins. You know, all due respect to Anthony Hopkins, but this is a very different Lecter. And this is, you know, if you've seen some of those interviews with real serial killers, this is what they're like.
Confidence, bluster, and aggression. Exactly. So let's dive into the scene. This is the first Lecter scene of the movie in a theatrical cut, which we're going to be talking to and unpacking, which you're going to be listening to momentarily. It starts at 23 minutes and 11 seconds. I'm going to get the scene up. Megan and I, in the Roger Ebert cinema interrupter style, are going to unpack this scene. We're going to watch bits of it. We're going to pause it. We're going to take it back. We're going to unpack everything. So from the outdoors, from the previous scene, from recovering the mindset, from these rich greens outside with Will and Jack Crawford, we dive into a stark white cell. So let me bring this scene up, and hopefully you guys enjoy listening to us tear it apart as Anthony Hopkins intimates that he will tear Will Graham. Brian Cox intimates as Hannibal Lecter that he'll tear Will Graham apart from behind this stark white cell. So here we go. I mean, look at this thing. I can't even help myself. It's been nice.
Because we have to talk about the white. That white on white on white. It's almost an unreal white. I mean, to me, it's the whiteness of the void. I don't know how he got that white. It's like a blue white. It's beyond cold. It's really like the whiteness of death.
It's the whiteness of science fiction movies where you see someone like walk into a space and it's just like, it's almost like a 2001 A Space Odyssey moment where you like walk in and just everything is this glacial white and you're like, this doesn't make any sense. And then you see Will walk in, he's got his blue, he's got the man blue ties. He's got some drip, William Peterson as Will Graham. He always looks very snappy in this, even though he looks disheveled and sleepless. But we've just paused it on the 23rd minute and 20 seconds, and he's literally dead center of frame with the big lock that's kind of above his head, and he's looking at something, and this, the whiteness is so creepy. And you look at this same scene, the way that it's reconstructed in Red Dragon, or you look at the same introduction scene of Clarice and Hannibal in Silence of the Lambs, and you know, it's like a dungeon. It's like you're keeping, you know, it's got lots of anticipation. There's lots of things that are drawn out, but the white of this room, after all of the color that we've seen so far, is like a you know, an aesthetic shakeup for your whole. It's like a palate cleanse. It's like, what are we about to see here? And it, I think the whiteness helps to just amplify everything that we're about to see.
Yeah, it's just like, it's just like Moby Dick kind of white as death feeling. You know, we've got this low angle here, which we don't know it yet till we reverse, but this is Lecter's angle because he's reclining. Yeah. So we, to begin with, his point of view seems very telling, very significant about who's in control of this scene.
Yes.
Can we stop it?
Yes.
I know we're not going to get through any of this, but he was so amazing how his hand, we see his hand on the top of his head first. His hand is like a claw.
Yes.
There's something very crab-like about him through this whole scene that that is so chill, like the cold, like cold-blooded.
Yes.
Tillian, and to have his hand shaped in that claw always scares me.
And
so
he doesn't, much. And he's, and you can hear him breathing. And I such a weird thing that you said, like reptilians, because you know what it's like. Sometimes you like you're laying on a couch or you're laying in your bed. You've got your arm in a bit of a weird position, especially readers. You know, you hold your hand up with your book, and there's just something about when you start to rouse. There's like a natural stretch, like you're stretching out. Oh, I'm a bit awkward. I'm uncomfortable. But the fact that his hand like barely moves and you're just sort of seeing his body rise and fall, it's so creepy because he doesn't stretch his fingers out immediately. You're like, this is weird. And he's breathing and he knows someone's there. And it's like, oh God, who is this? What is this? Most important.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, I love this, the whole, like just the choices of the compositions here, just like carving out these impossible angles, this shoulder shot where he's sort of blurred. And then it just, you know, crystallizes Lecter in the sort of lower right of the frame. Like you can almost barely make out his body. Fortunately, we've got like high definition, but I imagine in a cinema that bleed on a print at the time, you're kind of like squinting going, is that, I see a hand, I see a head, I can't make out his whole body. How big is this guy? It's so wonderfully put together.
And Peterson's so great when he walks in, because when he sits down, he actually pulls back. Like he's actually, he wears the fear and anxiety on his body in every gesture. And I think I just love how he sort of almost pushes back in the chair instantly. Yeah.
Like he even pulls the paper closer to him. He's like,
keeping
everything really tight and really close.
Yeah.
It's like with kids, do not feed the animals at the zoo. You know, keep your hands away from the cage. Don't touch the glass. Don't touch the white here.
That's the same atrocious aftershave you wore in court 3 years ago.
Yeah, I keep getting it for Christmas.
Did you get my car?
Oh my God. Did you get my car? It's the best.
He's established such an intimacy. He's suggesting this real intimate relationship, which is correct. They do have an intimate relationship. And I always forget how much smell plays into this, that you start, we're going to end with smell too.
Yes, yes.
Really throwing him off. Almost every third or fourth line of Lecter in this scene, he's saying something to throw him off. It's a non-sequitur. It's something we're not expecting. It's not what they're talking about. But I mean, this is it. Did you get my car? You know, like all of it feels like he keeps trying to keep him off balance.
Yes. And what's so funny about off balance is you would assume, or perhaps we've been generically coached that in these moments, he's saying horrific things, but he's saying, That's the same horrendous aftershave you wore 3 years ago. I remember your, what is he actually saying there? I remember the way you smell. That is creepy. Did you get my card? I've been thinking about you so much. And even now in 2024, it's even more extreme. Did you get my card? I've been thinking about you so much. I couldn't wait to put pen to paper and send you a snail mail card because, you know, it's not an email. It's not a text. Did you get my card? And he just, for a guy who was apparently just rousing from some kind of rest, he looks like in this spot that we've paused it, which is like 23 minutes, 52 seconds, his eyes look so clear and sharp. And he's already in this sort of leaning forward, silverback gorilla kind of posture straight at Graham. And so even though we know that there's some distance between them, it doesn't feel like there's any distance between them, which is just delightful.
No, and they've got that widow's peak that kind
of
makes it even feel more, there is these different sort of animal and reptile, all these sort of things. But yet he's, when he opens his mouth, he speaks, I mean, there's something, I love that Cox didn't do an American accent.
No.
Because there's something kind of, it's not how you expect him to sound. You're not quite, you can't quite place him. You're, you know, it's a little Scottish, but it's, you know, to an American audience, it probably sounds just British. And, but in a kind of very middle to working class tone.
Yes.
So it's, this is not some grand person putting on airs. This is something very regular about the way he talks.
Disarming, yes. Because he's working class. Yeah, as you said.
I got it, thank you. And how is Officer Stewart? The one who was first to see my basement. Stewart's fine. Emotional problems, I hear. Do you have any problems, Will?
No.
It's just... the one who first saw my basement is just like, what a poem. How was the first one to see my basement? Got some emotional problems. Do you have problems, Will?
And Peterson is so, his fear is so palpable, the way he's giving those short clipped answers. He already feels like he's back on his heels. And
yes.
There's so many more macho actors of this era that would not have played it that way. And I love how Peterson plays it.
And don't you love, he starts out and his head's almost raised, like his posture's a little bit raised. And then just as he's like focusing in, his head's lower in the frame. It's 24 minutes, 5 seconds. His head's lower in the frame. He's got that kind of bullet dimple in the chin and he's looking down. He's like, yeah, problems, Will. It's just a guy from behind bars is asking me if I have problems.
He's a therapist. and you know, we'll see this through the whole scene, but the way that man frames the two of them between the prison bars, the sort of the doubling that's critical to the whole movie, but it especially is established in this scene and in fact is the point of the scene in many ways, is just incredible. It's very film noir, it's very German expressionism to sort of use those bars for, you know, to have all this metaphoric meaning, but it's also a perfect way of getting us to hone in, you know, there's just no missing the aggression towards us.
That's the one aspect that I think is truly different between Hopkins and Cox, which is that Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, just because of the framing, the staging and everything like that, he's got such a monstrous, awful, weird, off-putting energy, but it kind of seems like a little bit aloof, like, you know, Clarice always feels kind of protected, even though they're closing the distance. And there's very few occasions where it's just with Clarice that she feels endangered by him. Whereas Cox here is, and he seems almost like laissez-faire, like Hopkins, he doesn't care. He's like, I'm not threatened by any of you. You can't hurt me. And I don't really want to hurt you because I can't be bothered unless you're rude. And then I'll sort of do it. He's sort of more, cruel in that way, whereas Cox immediately is like, I'm a dangerous animal and I will hurt you. So that's what I like about the scene, because it's not blustery, But there's just something about the posture. Like even the posture in Hopkins in Lambs, he's like completely, you know, vertical.
Yeah,
very rigid and tall. And this sort of crouching, there's just something about just crouching and leaning.
Yeah, no, it's like, I know he was inspired by a couple different Scottish serial killers, and it does have that kind of, you know, who appeared very regular men, but that he talked about how they were constructs, and you could see it. They were going to give you this thing, but you know, if you really see what's beneath this construct, and you can sort of see, feel the pressure of it pressing through. And I think, you know, he's got this sheen of faux politeness, asking how everyone's doing, you know, but all of it has this sense of menace underneath it, that at any minute, you know, you're going to see his true self, which is lurking.
I'm glad you came. My callers are mostly clinical psychologists from Cornfield University somewhere. Second raters, the lot.
Dr. Bloom showed me your article on surgical addiction in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry.
And?
Very interesting. Even to a layman. I want you to help me, Dr. Lecter.
I thought so.
I love that. I want you to help me. Yes.
He sees right through the trying to flatter him by yeah. the article. And this is then immediately you see Will between the prison bars. He's got him already caught there. And he wants something from him. And you see the transactional nature of the enterprise revealing itself. Though, of course, it's really a different transaction than the obvious one. There's a manifest transaction, which, you know, is about information, help, the file. And then there's the other one, which is that was revealed at the end of the scene when Lecter identifies why Will's really there.
Yeah. And all those questions that lead up to it are just such a mounting.
Yes.
You want to know why you're here, Will? Dum, dum, dum. We'll get to that.
I want you to help me, Dr.
I love his smile.
Yes. In the papers. I don't tear out the articles. I wouldn't want them to think I was dwelling on anything morbid. You want to know how he's choosing them, don't you?
I thought you might have some ideas.
Why should I tell you?
You get to see the file in this case. And there's another reason.
Pray tell.
Thought you might be curious to see if you're smarter than the person I'm looking for.
Then by implication, you think you're smarter than me since you caught me.
I know that I'm not smarter than you.
Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Okay, that line was that I have always remembered. It is such a terrifying line because of the way they're talking. Like, they've gotten into a real back and forth. And there's something so, like, it gets to the heart of, we could forget for a moment that Lecter's just not the expert here. And they're making a trade, but and you know, they're kind of doing this dance, but that's, I think, Will, the only thing he really gets in there. The whole thing. It's just such a great delivery, the way it's just boom, ba boom, ba boom. Well, you're insane.
it turns into a Powlin Pressburger pitter patter for like 5 seconds. It's where they're just going back. I thought you might think you're smarter, but then by implication, you think that you're smarter than me.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh no, and I'm not smarter than you.
Just like leveling, because it's just both. There's something, I guess, that feels like it hits a deep truth about the fantasy of the genius serial killer.
Yeah.
The way we're defining genius there is deeply fraught and problematic because there's something so wrong at the center of their brain that is always going to catch them, you know, that they're always There's a compulsion that they can't, that they can't control, and they're, and that is their weakness. And that's, of course, what Will knows, is that's the thing that's the most dangerous, and it's the thing that you, that's how you catch them ever, is that they're not geniuses, they're not brilliant. They're very damaged people who are going to screw up because they can't stop themselves.
Yes. And that just finally, like it just, it's a such a cutting thing that I think so many other entries in the genre don't get to as quickly and as incisively. You had disadvantages. What's disadvantages? You're insane. Like the way that you do things, it might be this beautiful architectural, symbolic experience that you're exercising through your compulsion, but you're ultimately normal people don't do that.
Yeah, and Will's just not going to play
No.
anymore. And I love how he just cuts. He's not going to do a 2-hour dance with him about this. That I think that is a thing that most serial killer movies do like to do, is that endless dance where they're not saying the most obvious thing, which Will just said, is one of the things I love about this movie.
25 minutes, 12 seconds. Look at William Peterson's perfect face frame between the bars. You're insane. And it's just such a matter of fact, incisive. And then he's almost at that moment, as you said, he's just leveling the playing field. He's like, okay, like if we're gonna talk, let's actually talk. Let's have a conversation. And this is and how we level set is me being really candid here. And just this pause, I've paused it immediately after the line, and we're gonna hear it in a second as I turn it back on. But there's just like a lovely. There's a beat you could fly a 747 through. It's just you just some nice beat before the next part of the conversation. I love Cox's face when you get the reverse shot on him. Like, okay. This is how we're gonna play. It's so lovely.
You are very tan, Will.
Straight back to
Your
him.
hands are rough. They don't look like cops' hands anymore. And that shaving lotion is something a child would select. It has a ship on the board.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Don't think you can persuade me with appeals to my intellectual vanity.
I don't think I'll persuade you at all. You'll either do it or you won't. Besides, we have Dr. Bloom working on it, and he's the best.
Do you have the file with you?
Yes.
Pictures?
Yes.
Let me have them, and I might consider it.
No.
I love 25 minutes, 53 seconds. I love that. I love it's like I also that's the other thing that people think about the insanity line, but I love this. It's like you'll either do it or you won't. Like the
Yeah.
fact that so many of these scenes in serial killer movies, it's just like Silence of the Lambs, except Silence of the Lambs, it's more intertwined and tangled because obviously Buffalo Bill and Lecter have a shared
Right.
connection in the past, which is just that extra. Rather than simply Buffalo Bill being a fan of Lecter, but rather there's just something extra going on between them in that book and in that film. But I love here, it's like you'll either do it or you won't.
Yeah.
Like and which is really smart and really fantastic in the writing and great in Peterson's performance. But it also leads to, as you said, it like we're all crescendoing to this moment where he's already told us he's front run. I'm recovering the mindset. Why are you here? But it just shows you how he's gets to play with these characters. It's like I'm not here for your vanity. You're going to do it or you're not going to do it. My investigation's going to go on, and sort of has to make them both important and unimportant so that he maintains some kind of power. And right now they're kind of level. They are sort of level, even though that Cox's Lecter is just like ever so closer encroaching, somehow making it even closer and more uncomfortable with every second that we're in this damn cell.
But I think you're right. I think actually this is the last moment where Will has slightly the upper hand because he's seen how much Lecter wants that file now. Like
Oh, yeah.
Lecter can see, like he's moving
Pictures, pictures.
forward. He's dying for it, you know. His tongue is practically hanging out of his mouth, and you know, like that's the only thing he has, and he, you know, he's saying this is the last time he's got that bit of control here, and it's gonna turn soon.
And I just love his, I don't know, there's such a performance choice for him too. His like mouth's open a lot. He's just kind of, when
Yes,
he's considering, is like
totally.
his mouth's open, and it's just sav it's more savage. I don't know what it is. You know, much love to the Academy Award-winning actor Anthony Hopkins, but I can't get enough of Cox. And so he's so funny because in his latest interviews as an older man, he's always like, people are like, oh, Manhunter's great. And he's like, it was, I worked for 2 hours. Like,
Yeah.
I worked for 2 hours, like nearly 40 years ago. I don't remember. It's
Yeah.
fine. Michael seemed like a nice guy. I did it. That's it. That's all I remember. But man, talk
No.
about immortality in a
Yeah.
scene. It's right here.
Absolutely.
Dream much, Will?
Well, that's another one where he throws him back on his heels. A non sequitur is what he's really great at. And it is a therapist trick too, of course.
Yes.
Because he sort of like talks about what they're re finally p there's no more text now. He just keeps going to subtext, and that's
Yes.
the subtext is why he's here. And Will immediately knows he's been caught out there and jumps to his feet.
He
It's so
jumps to
great.
his feet. It's 25 minutes, 58 seconds, and it's the exact inverse of the shot that we originally saw, which is that
Yes.
he's in control. The power, even though it's Lecter's gaze, it's the power dynamic of Will coming in tall, Lecter being low, and immediately right now the camera arches up to this sort of surveillance view where like Will's being pushed down, and it now looks like Will's in the cage
Yes.
versus Lecter. It's so magnificent. Just again, all these implicit, beautiful tricks and techniques that, you know, I think people talk about them in film school, or people like myself, you ultimately, when you sort of get in that real academic weeds, you start talking about the technique of why you would use that. And in writing, there's so many equivalencies, but it's like, yeah, but when all these tricks mean nothing if the text and subtext of the scene doesn't work, like it kind of feels flashy if it's unnecessary, but here it feels like it makes total sense. Like the power has shifted. Dream much, Will. Bang. That's, he's got him. I'm inside your head again.
He's right in there, and Will knows it, and there's no, this is, it's all bad from
It's all,
here.
yeah. He's like, as soon as he asked me that, he's going to keep prodding, and I'm not ready yet. As we're seeing in this scene, it's like
Yeah.
he's showed a good game for a few minutes, but he has only been with this man for like 2 minutes and like 40 seconds, and that's enough to make his skin crawl.
Yeah, and to completely unwind him. You know, he's in bad shape now, and you can feel it from here on out.
Oh, it's excellent.
You haven't threatened to take away my books yet. Let me have the file, and I'll tell you what I think.
It's his, and you don't even see him on screen. It's his most cute. He's like, no, you haven't taken, no, we haven't done the
Same
dance yet.
song delivery. It's just incredible.
And then the camera. Oh, are we gonna get some? No, Will's still squashed. Look at that. He's on his
So
tippy
far back.
toes, Megan.
This is one of my favorite things are those toes, those stocking feet, the tippy toes, like a little ballerina there. It's amazing because he also the la later scene will make use of this too. How small he is,
Yes.
Cox, short man, and but we made even shorter by the way he shot it, and somehow that makes him so much more frightening.
Yes.
Because he's something like a delicacy to him here, and but you feel that sort of seething thing beneath it.
And he's just got this little smile. He's like, oh, I've got you wrapped around my finger now. His hands are
He's having so much fun.
entangled. Oh, he's having a ball. And Will looks like hell.
And Lecter, this is when he knows he's gonna get that file.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. looks so miserable.
Oh, he looks absolutely miserable. And he's just, I love, he's just looking the blankness of this cell.
And I love this sort of drifting over to the books where you have this sort of acid color of the green and the lavender. It feels so upsetting to the eye after all the
white. All the white.
That color there. This is a very shy boy, Will.
I love this. It's 27 seconds, 27 minutes, 11 seconds, where it's the perfect match cut between the Will's perspective of scanning, where he's just kind of getting lost in trying to consume everything in the cell. What can I learn from it? What can I glean from him? What upper hand can I get? And then he goes, this is a very shy boy, Will. And he just sort of snaps back to...
Yes. Yeah.
But he's the composure is no longer there. Like the harshness, the sturdiness of his face is not there. Now it's back to curiosity. And he sort of then knows, and this is, as you said, like Lecter knows that he's got the upper hand in the rest of the conversation, because anything here actually might be worth his time.
Right. That's right.
And it's that, God, he's got a great face. William Peterson should have made 20 movies.
I know.
Like this.
I had such a crush on him when I saw this. He's so intense, and he's so vulnerable. That looking at him right like that, there is something like a little boy here. Like, you have to give me what I want, but he also feels so exposed and vulnerable because he knows that Lecter can see right through him.
What were the yards like?
Big backyards, fences, hedges. Why?
Because, my dear Will, if this pilgrim imagines he has a relationship with the moon, he might go outside to look at it. Have you ever seen blood on the moonlight, Will? It appears quite black.
Beautiful line. I never forget that line.
If this pilgrim, love that.
So great. It's like he makes it so visual, yeah, almost romantic, and because it's absolutely terrifying, but he paints this sort of romantic vision. And he knows
it's just like, it's like, oh, he makes it romantic. It's absolutely terrifying. But as I was-
because it's so seductive, the pilgrim and the whiteness and the blackness and this sort of, you know.
That's the name of a romance novel. If it's not, someone missed. Pilgrim in the Moonlight? Are we kidding?
Like, he's finding the poetry in these details, and he knows Will is too, and he's trying to draw Will in. Like, can't you see the way that blood looks in the moon? Of course, we do see that in the movie.
Yes.
We do see that exact black blood.
It appears quite black.
Great delivery.
If one knows, right, it would be better to have privacy for this sort of thing.
That's interesting.
No, it's not. You thought of it before.
Before we get to this, there's a Mark, I want to shout him out. Mark E. Vildemuth wrote a book called, its subheading is Michael Mann and the Information Age. And I've had this book for maybe nearly two decades now. But the title of the book is Blood in the Moonlight. Is the title of his book. So I want to shout him out. Because he does, there's really some really, really fantastic work that he does examining Manhunter, and his chapter on the book is Renewed Dialogue, Indirect Light, Complexity and Exchange in Manhunter. It's really terrific. In the research of this series, I've been doing it, but I've been poring over it and rereading it again because I read it many, many years ago. But it's just that scene. So we'll just quickly go back for a split second because I want to get into this exchange in detail. Yeah. But yeah, I wanted to shout him out because it's very, very, very good.
This is a very shy boy, Will. What were the yards like?
Big backyards, fences, hedges.
Why? Because, my dear Will, if this pilgrim imagines he has a relationship with the moon, he might go outside to look at it. Have you ever seen blood on the moonlight? Well, it appears quite black. If one were nude, it would be better to have privacy for this sort of thing.
If one were nude, like, again, if one were nude, it would be better to have privacy for that sort of thing. Like, yeah, the murder isn't of itself already ghastly. It's talking about it like it's skinny dipping.
He is, and he there's an intimacy. He's talking to Will as if Will were like him and they were like the killer.
Yes.
The way, even the tinkling music, there's something very seductive about this moment. And I think the language he's using is the language of seduction, that they are, the three of them are in this together. They understand this, they understand the poetry of it, which I think is just like, it's just great writing. But this also, everything man is doing here with the prison cell bars around them, with the directing the performance, everything is contributing to that sense of Will's being sucked into something, and he feels it, and can barely breathe here, it seems like.
And it's also, there's one thing that I hadn't thought of until we were just talking now, but it's like, well, you're going to go and dance around in these backyards too. Like he's almost telling him, go to the backyards. Like, go to the backyards. You're going to find some other details there that you haven't looked at. Because it's not just the temple of the homes and the rooms and the spaces and what is being seen. It's that it's this sort of safe zone, this little like little orbital thing that he's occupying this space while they're still alive, and then he goes in to create these death scenes. But he's so late, and again, 27 minutes 36 seconds. If you're not watching this, like Peterson now is stern and vulnerable because it's almost like he's mad that he's getting these details, he's getting them together. But again, he's still deeply, as you said, vulnerable in this scene, deeply vulnerable. And it's like, as he's teasing this information out, it's like, okay, this is, it's still so hard for him to just keep staring at being in this man's presence.
That's interesting.
No, it's not. You've thought of it before.
I considered it.
You came here to look at me, to get the old scent back again, didn't you?
I want your opinion.
I don't have one right now.
Well, when you have one, I'd like to hear it.
Can I keep this?
I haven't decided yet.
I'll study them. When you get more files, I'd like to see them too. You can call me when I have to call my lawyer. They bring me a telephone. Would you like to leave me your home phone number?
Okay. This is such an amazing turn. The music changes if we didn't already feel, but the way the music comes in is, this is where he feels like the visit is ending and he needs to get these things. And he's actually threatening him quite
Yes.
directly here,
Yes.
as direct as he gets. And it's bone chilling, that turn.
I just love that's interesting. And he goes, no, it's not. No, it isn't. You considered it.
I mean, who's flattering who here? I mean, he just knows, I mean, it's never any nothing more terrifying than having someone who knows your darkest thoughts. But if that person is also a serial killer and they seem to know you, I mean, it's really getting at some existential horror of your shadow being exposed. But I think the way Lecter, there's a little bit of desperation here because he feels like it's ending, and he wants these things, he wants them badly. But there's also part of it, like him wanting you, like, we're gonna be on this team together, Will. I better have more access to you, and then the real threat, which he means. I mean, he means it, as we will see later in the movie. So yeah, I think
Can
it's
I have your
such a
home phone number? Goodbye,
man.
Dr. Lee.
My God. I mean, the whole scene is a real dance, and like, we've seen all these turns, and this is the turn where it's just too far. This is the equivalent of him reaching for his throat.
Yes. No. Can I have your home phone number? No. I just love it. It's the most honest Will has been in this room. Can I have your home phone number? No. You can't have my home phone number.
Goodbye, Dr. Lecter. You can leave messages for me at the number on
You
your
know
file.
how you caught me? The reason you caught me, Will, is because you're just the light. You want the scent? Smell yourself.
Oh,
The best, the
the
best.
best, the
And
best.
I love how he does not intone it in Shakespeare, as we know Cox do. There's something really low and mean and true about that smell
You want the
yourself.
scent? recover the mindset, right? We're all it didn't bury the lead. We knew exactly why Will was there. But what's so funny is that, you know why you caught me, Will? You know why you caught me? Goodbye, Dr. Lecter. Bang. He's up. He's smashing the door. Bang, bang, bang. It's 28 minutes, 23 seconds where we've paused, which is the conclusion of that line. Bang, bang, bang. You know why you caught me? You want the scent. Smell yourself. Oh.
It's just lacerating. And then you're back. Then we're back with Lecter in that cell. This is like the first time you see like the toilet and the smallness of it and how small Lecter is. But he doesn't need to be big now. It's the contagion has passed to Will.
Yes.
Walking out with the danger now.
Yes. And like recovering the mindset has a toll.
Yes.
And it's 2 minutes. It's like it's a couple of minutes in with this guy, and look what he can do.
And he's revealed something that we didn't actually know. You know, we thought we were watching the scene for the information he could give too.
Yes.
And that was not till the end that Lecter reveals to us what was really happening. And then there's something upsetting to us about Will, you know, that's what's happening.
For the whole scene, how is this guy so good?
Yeah, boy.
That he thinks like a serial killer, and that at any moment, and it really changes the entire, we've already spoken about it on a couple of episodes, and it's like Graham in the hotel, like watching the footage and some of the scenes leading up to this is this guy who is, for whatever reason, cannot feel comfort the way that he and Kim Grice, Molly, feel in this beautiful, like, ocean bathe light nighttime love scene. He feels more comfortable in a dark, personalityless hotel room in front of a television set watching videos of victims before they die to try and think about like how someone would want to kill them. it's really disturbing, which is at the core of this, which is, as you said, it's the myth, and it's also the poking the holes in the myth. It's like there is a toll for thinking like a serial killer every day.
He will always be a man apart, and we will see after this movie thousands of ripoffs of this kind of story, and they will all make it much more glamorous.
Yes.
What that's like, but here we really see how ugly it is for Will. It has to carry this thing in him that,
yes.
And I think there's something so simple and so upsetting about it that,
yes,
he has to now carry this, and he has to do this to himself over and over again. It's his compulsion.
It's so magnificent. I just want to make sure that I mentioned, because we're this is where we are. The locations, so there were different filming locations, all like different places all around the country, for this one, and I'm just trying to find, so in the I'm trying to just, sorry, I've got to just find the
this is an amazing building.
Oh, it's an amazing building. So it's shot in like Atlanta. It's shot in Georgia, Chicago, Illinois. And where is the museum? I'm so sorry. I had it on my notes.
Why are you
here.
Looking? Because we're about to see it. I think it's so 80s. This Mindhunter will really make use of these buildings like these Panopticon buildings.
Yes.
So popular, which you know was originally a prison, the original Panopticon prison, and the idea was that you could, you know, the central tower could see everyone all at all times, you know, the wardens could see all the prisoners at all times, and so many buildings from that era had that kind of structure, that kind of circular structure, and it's perfect for what's going on in Will's head right now.
It's perfect. It's the High Museum of Art. It was in Atlanta, Georgia, which is because it's got this, because it's meant to be this top, top security institution, but they use the building that we're about to see as Will rushes out as the exterior for this great cell. Love that. Smell yourself. And now we get to see this panopticon, as you called it, the building, unfold before us. And the drone, here he goes. Oh, this is so great.
His point of view, so we feel his disorientation. And there's the full, that's total panopticon.
Yes. 28 minutes, 38, I've paused it. It's just like, you've got this big tundra, if you like, this huge, like, circular inside of the building where people can walk down in one big row, and he's carving through in this zigzag, trying to cut through the architecture, and he's sprinting and streaming out of the building, and it's
very vertigo-ish.
Yes, he's just completely out of breath. He's out of breath from the second he walks out the door. It's not fitness. It's I can't be in this building anymore. Where's the exit? I love all the vacant, curious faces that see him as he through his perspective as well, like kind of like looking at him like, what is wrong with this guy?
Yeah.
Oh.
And that's POV shots. Yeah, they have go through the door as he goes through the door. And then you have this this magnificent building.
Yes.
This again is the kind of stuff that man gets dinged with. But this is a movie very much about institutions and their attempt to understand what is ungovernable, what is the opposite of logical, rational structures. And I think it really serves a purpose here. And also this is like a maze, a trap, everything about how Will feels too, all those sharp lines. And it's like the prison bars are now on the outside, you know, because now we're looking at these walkways with these rails, we're looking at the panes on the windows, everything is like a cell.
And you're so right as well. It's like the other thing that happens when you watch this so many times, as probably both of us have over our time, is you imagine the walk to the cell is almost as disorientating as the exit, because you're making your way through this maze of white, or these white uniformed police. You're going in there and you're walking up these stairs and you're, you know, losing your breath if you're walking up everyone sort of briskly, and then entering this space. And then there's that anticipation, which is why he's so desperate to get out of there, is that like, I've walked all the way into the bowels of this disgusting, you know, like white, bone white prison. I've walked into it and now I've got to get the hell out. And at least he can, but like, he's now, it's just like bursting out, coming here. There's still no life to be had as he sort of stumbles down. I want to get to this with you, Megan. It's like he stumbles, he's catching his breath, he's completely disorientated, and then, as you said, he sees the grass.
It's such a great, so we have his point of view, so how he sees it in his, it's a panic attack he's had.
Yes, yes. Like a
classic panic attack, and if you've ever had one, that's just what happens. And so now we have this, you know, we were talking about expressionists. This is almost like an impressionist.
It is, it's a Monet, it is, absolutely.
Yeah. And until he regains his
undoes the tie at the top button.
Yeah, amazing.
And then we get the grass.
Peace. For the soul 2 seconds for the rest of the movie.
his last bit of peace. And that's the conclusion.
Already caught back up.
Yeah, exactly as you said. There's like, we see this last tiny flick of grass. 29 seconds, 25 is where the grass appears. The end of the scene, as I've sort of marked them out, is literally as we hear those cameras snap, 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 snap with Freddie Lowndes.
Amazing. Oh, perfect scene.
What a magnificent scene. What a magnificent time I've had talking to you about it. Isn't it just wonderful? Isn't he?
It is. I've seen it so many times, and then mentioned stuff I hadn't even thought of. It just shows how rich a text it is, that you can still keep seeing things in it every time. And I think it really is that. I mean, it's so short too. I'm always amazed at how much story, character, psychology is packed in there.
That's the thing that, if there's any one element of the great things, the great texts that I find myself obsessing over, is economy. It's how quickly you can get to the point. And like, it's the absolute inversion of what I do, because I'm trying to squeeze all of that stuff out of there. But I think that that's why I get so, I marvel at it, because, you know, in your daily life, I'm probably sure you hear it too. Like, some folks will go, oh, do you ever watch this TV show? Oh, like it's 7 seasons long and there's 23 episodes a season. They're all 40 minutes each. And it really warms up in season 3. And I'm like, are you kidding? There are 2-hour movies that, and a scene we've just watched, which is essentially 6 minutes and 20 seconds we watched together, that I could watch endlessly, because there's probably things that we didn't even quite touch on and cover. And it's just like, from, as you said, from an aesthetic perspective, a psychological perspective, a storytelling, the economy, the scripting, the performance, every little detail, it's so rich. So yeah, I find myself going back and back and back to movies just like this, because, you know, some people are like, oh, the show takes a half a season. I'm like, half a season? Try 6 minutes. Like, 6 minutes, this should be done. Like, we should be ready to roll. If it can do it in Manhunter, you should be able to do it. It was made in 1986. Like, let's sort it out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all there. It's all there. And it really is the sort of, to me, the beginning and the peak of this kind of genre. I don't think it gets farther than this. I mean, Mindhunter, I think you could make an argument it does interesting things with it, but that's many hours long. That's
many.
Like 25 hours long, wherever, you know.
And it has many serial killers to play with, right? Like, the whole first season is just like dancing with people Kemper. Yeah. You know, you've got BTK, who's just like a presence in the series.
That really is more about the profilers, which is really interesting. But what I love here is, I mean, in many ways, like classic film noir of doubling, of the terror of seeing yourself exposed. Smell yourself. I mean,
smell
come
yourself.
On.
Come on. You want the scent back. Smell yourself. It's great. Megan Abbott, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me again.
It's such
a treat, and this was so fun. So thank you so much again. People can find all of your stuff, meganabbott.com. They can find everything that you're doing and all of your new books and get all the news that they need. But look, I appreciate your time so much. This has been a blast and a very upsetting scene, but also just a total delight to talk to you about.
Yes, a lot of laughs for such a horrifying scene.
I think that was more about us. The only reaction you can have when faced with such sheer terror is to just cackle. Like, oh God, at least I'm doing it from the comfort of my house. I'm not scared of this scene. Exactly. All right, mate. You're the best. Thank you so much for your time, guys. Thanks so much for listening or watching. And thank you so much. This has been an episode of Mindhunter, the latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I, and all modern man movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there. And the Jimmy Carn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon / One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron, for as little as $1 a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Mindhunter episode, Mindhunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Scott Campbell from the Stupid Things for Love podcast. I have a 7-year-old son, and the biggest mountain I climb every day is trying to put shoes on this child. And I'm so grateful to Skechers for making the only shoes my son will willingly put on by himself. Their slip-ons are amazing, and he doesn't have to deal with laces, he doesn't have to deal with anything. They come in the perfect color blue. Thank you, Skechers, the comfort technology company. And you can find Skechers everywhere, Skechers.com, a Skechers store, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.